The Power and Joy of Altruism.
It's easy to look at her, what she does, and characterize her as some sort of saint, and she hates that. I mean, she's definitely no martyr. I think really what she is a seeker of joy.
That's Jessica Yu. Her book, Garden of the Lost and Abandoned, tells the extraordinary story of a Ugandan journalist and the children she saves. But first, we talk with the best-selling author of The Bridge to Terabithia about the Cuban literacy campaign of 1961 and its teenage heroes.
I had never heard of the literacy campaign in Cuba in 1961. And then I began to do research and found these amazing stories. And I was particularly moved by the stories of the young teenage girls who left their safe homes in the cities and where they were being groomed for proper marriages and hardly went out on the street alone. Most of them had never spent a night away from home, and they went up into the mountains and into the countryside where there was no electricity, no running water, no plumbing, and where you brought the water from the river for all of your needs, and you washed your laundry on the rocks by the river, and then worked side by side with the campesinos in the fields, and then at night, under a large lantern provided by the Chinese government, you taught the campesinos how to read and write.
That's Catherine Patterson talking about her new YA novel, My Brigadista Year. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On January 1, 1959, Fidel Castro and his band of revolutionaries marched into Havana and overthrew the brutal regime of Fulgencio Batista. One of the first promises Fidel made was to bring universal literacy to the Cuban people, which at that time was only around 60%. On January 1, 1961, 2 years later, the literacy campaign was kicked off. At year's end, the percentage of Cubans who were literate had risen to 96%. It was a remarkable achievement, one that is unique in the speed and scope of its accomplishment. And it was done almost entirely by teenagers, educated largely urban kids who were recruited into the literacy brigades by the Cuban government. My guest, Catherine Patterson, author of the beloved classic Bridge to Terabithia, tells the little-known story of the Cuban literacy campaign in her new historical novel, My Brigadista Year. It recounts the coming of age of Laura, a 13-year-old girl from Havana who leaves her sheltered life to teach her fellow Cubans to read and write in spite of dangers and privation, and who learned some important lessons about herself along the way. Catherine Patterson is the author of more than 30 books, including 16 novels for children and young people. She's twice won the Newbery Medal for Bridge to Terabithia in 1978 and Jacob Have I Loved in 1981. Catherine Patterson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. I'm delighted to be here.
This book, My Brigadista Year, is about the literacy campaign in Cuba. Tell us about that campaign. Just give us the historical setting to begin with.
Fidel Castro became the, whatever you want to call him, he was the premier of the dictator of Cuba in 1959, January. And in the fall of 1960, he addressed the United Nations, and he said that in 1 year, Cuba will become a fully literate nation. And, of course, everybody went, hoo, hoo, hoo. And he came back to Cuba, and he asked for volunteers. He got something like 750,000 volunteers. More than half of them were female. About 108,000 of them were between the ages of 12 and 18. And they went out into the countryside and into the mountains and taught the campesinos how to read and write. And at the end of the year, the UN observers declared Cuba a fully literate nation.
So now, why did you take up the theme of this revolutionary struggle?
Well, I've been involved with literacy for many, many, many years. And I learned from actually Mary Leahy, who is Senator Leahy's sister, and who has been involved with adult literacy in Vermont for all of her career. And I have worked some with the literacy work in Vermont since I lived here. And I was telling Mary that I was going back to Cuba for a visit, and she said, I'm so jealous. Pat gets to go to Cuba all the time, but I've never been. And she said, you know, when I began to work with adult literacy in Vermont, I got a lot of ideas from the Great Literacy Campaign of 1961 in Cuba. And I had never heard of the Literacy Campaign in Cuba in 1961. And she told me to go read Jonathan Kozol's book, Children of the Revolution. And then I began to do research and found these amazing stories. And I was particularly moved by the stories of the young teenage girls who left their safe homes in the cities and where they were being groomed for proper marriages and hardly went out on the street alone. Most of them had never spent a night away from home, and they went up into the mountains and into the countryside where there was no electricity, no running water, no plumbing, and where you brought the water from the river for all of your needs, and you washed your laundry on the rocks by the river and then worked side by side with the campesinos in the fields, and then at night under a large lantern provided by the Chinese government, you taught the campesinos how to read and write. And it was a life-changing event for these young women, and they have become amazing professional women in the life of Cuba. I learned, much to my amazement, that the woman who had initially invited me to Cuba and has since become my closest Cuban friend, that she too had been a brigadista as a teenager. And she is this strong, outspoken woman that when I learned she had been a brigadista, I sort of thought, well, that sort of explains why Amelia is the kind of person she is. Because it seemed that all of those young women came out of that experience stronger and with a lot of self-esteem and the knowledge that they could accomplish great things.
And you have as your protagonist one of them, and this is Laura. Tell us about Laura. She's a remarkably attractive protagonist.
Well, thank you, because people don't think that about all my protagonists. but she is, you know, a beloved child in a home in Havana, a family that strongly supported the revolution and believed that with the coming of Fidel Castro, there would be a new day for Cuba, and there was a great deal of hope. And when she saw the notice that volunteers were being needed for the campaign, if you can read and write, then you should teach someone else how to read and write. So she loved the idea of being able to be independent and not being always told not to stay out in the sun for fear her skin would get dark and to not dirty her pretty dress. And so the idea of joining in a campaign was very exciting to her. I think she sort of knew there would be hardships, but she had no idea just how hard life would be. You know, she's really inspired by the interviews I've seen with women who took part in the campaign. And everything, really, that happens to Laura happened to somebody. And I've just sort of gathered a lot of those stories and put them into one person.
Now, she came from a middle-class family in Havana. Her parents were initially reluctant to let her go, but more for safety reasons. They were not against the idea of this literacy campaign. Why was her family, who, after all, were middle class, why were they supporters of the revolution?
Well, Batista, who had been the ruler for many years, was a horrible, horrible man. He was hand in gloves with the American mafia. He was a totally corrupt government, and the Cuban people suffered terribly under him, the ordinary Cuban people. So, yes, when Fidel Castro made an effort to overthrow Batista, Laura's uncle was killed in the first skirmish with the Batista forces. So they had great hopes that it would be a wonderful new day for Cuba. Of course, you know, a lot of things happened in the years between 1961 and today that were very difficult for many Cubans, and many Cubans fled, and many were imprisoned because of standing up against Fidel and speaking too freely out against him. But good things also happened, of which we don't know so much about. One is that Cuba has more than a 99% literacy rate even today, and there's free education from kindergarten through a doctoral degree, and there's excellent health care system available to every Cuban. So not everything is bad in Cuba. We don't like to hear good things about our enemies, but we probably should.
Right. And actually, I can tell our listeners that I went to Cuba in 1969 to 1970. I was there as part of a group of North American volunteers who went to participate in the so-called 10 million ton sugar harvest. The group was called the Venceremos Brigade.
Really? That's fascinating.
Yeah. We took a trip around the island and talked to people all over the place, and I have to say that people came up to us everywhere and told us how proud they were to be Cubans. I mean, these were ordinary Cubans who, before the revolution, had not had a roof over their heads, had not been able to get enough to eat. And they did now. They had free education and they had free health care. And yes, I do understand that it's certainly not an unsullied record by any means. When I was there, for example, homosexuals were being jailed. So I'm not being an apologist, but I was impressed that a society, it was the first time I'd ever felt that I was in a society that at least tried to put the interests of the people first. And this campaign that you write about in this book, Catherine Patterson, that you write about in My Brigadista Year, really expresses that. And I wonder if you could talk about the methods of the literacy campaign, because they really exemplify how much of a break with previous ways of thinking about poor people the Cuban Revolution was.
Well, I think that was one of Fidel Castro's aims in the literacy campaign. There was such a divide between the people in the city and the people in the country. You know, suspicion and the city people looking down on the country people. And he felt that if the city people went to the country and lived along with the campesinos, the peasants, and understood what their life was like, there would be a totally different feeling and more of a we're all one country than Cubans had known previously. And I have this quotation, which I keep repeating over and over again because I think it's so meaningful, from one young woman who had, as a young woman, had been a literacy worker, a brigadista, and she said, "I taught the campesinos how to read and write, and they taught me how to be a person."
Hmm.
And I just think that's so significant, because that was really one of his aims. And you know, one of the problems in our own country is that there's so little sense of the common good. And, I mean, you can go to the left as far as you want to go, and you can go to the right as far as you want to go. And we seem to be encouraging people to think only of their own needs and their own goals and not to think of the good of the country as a whole.
I think that's so true. That's so perceptive. And that really comes out in this wonderful novel. I'm speaking with Catherine Patterson, best-selling author of A Bridge to Terabithia, and she's now turned her pen to the Cuban Literacy Campaign of 1961. The novel is My Brigadista Year, and it is just a joy to read. It is a novel for the middle grades, but enjoyable by anybody of any age. There is a very important grandmother figure in this book. Tell us about her.
Well, she's a revolutionary figure. Not modeled after my own grandparents, grandmothers who nearly gave up on me because I would never be the nice girl they wanted me to be. But grandmother here says to her son, who understandably does not want his only daughter to go running off into the mountains to a dangerous and difficult place, she says to him that a new age demands new people. And she feels truly that it is a new age in Cuba, and therefore we have to learn new ways. And I think, I mean, I love that grandmother, obviously. I felt it was somewhat understandable that her parents would be so fearful for their child. And of course, the grandmother knows perfectly well that it's going to be a very difficult life, and her granddaughter has no notion of how difficult it's going to be, because she's just got stars in her eyes right now. And she warns her granddaughter that it's going to be more difficult than she could imagine. But she, I think, loves the idea that this grandchild of hers has the courage and the idealism to take on this task, which is going to be for the good of the whole country.
And so I don't want to give too much away here, but, you know, it is in fact a very dangerous thing, and she is part of what is called the Conrado Benitez Brigade. There's a very famous song that was written about Conrado Benitez. So tell us about Conrado Benitez and the dangers that the literacy workers faced.
Well, Conrado Benitez was an 18-year-old who, before the actual formal literacy campaign began, was in the Escambray Mountains teaching the peasants there how to read and write. And he was killed by the insurgents who had fled to the mountains, those who had supported Batista. So he became really the martyr of the campaign, and the young volunteers were called the Conrado Benitez Brigade, and they were the Brigadistas. And it was a brigade because they wore uniforms, and they were like an army, but they were an army that carried pencils and notebooks and not guns. So I think Laura also loved the idea of wearing a uniform instead of a dress that had to be kept clean.
And so the dangers that were faced by them, tell us what happens to Laura, not in the sense of a plot, but in the sense of how she grew emotionally through confronting these dangers and through doing this very important work in the literacy campaign.
Well, she always maintains that she is not a hero. I mean, I'm looking at her, I think she was a hero, but you know, she wants you to know that she's just an ordinary person. But this extraordinary thing happened in her life, and it was the most important influence on the person, the woman that she eventually became. But she goes with some understandable nervousness and fear to be trained to be a brigadista. And while she's there at the training facility, the Bay of Pigs is invaded. The bombers come and bomb, and then the invaders come at the Bay of Pigs. And, of course, her parents are terrified, and her father comes to take her home, and she refuses to go because she said she signed up and she can't leave. I mean, she could have left, but she was determined not to leave. And so then the next thing, she goes back into the mountains where Conrado Benitez himself was killed, the very same mountain area. And there's still these insurgents there that are up there. And somebody asked me, well, why were they determined to kill the literacy workers? Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, it seems so strange. I can understand why they'd want to kill the other soldiers and militia who were up Fidel Castro's forces, because that's whom they were opposing. But why did they feel that the literacy volunteers were a threat? I haven't been inside their minds, so I don't know. But there was that threat, and another volunteer was killed while Laura was there, and also a number of the farmers who had housed the volunteers and supported them were killed. So it was a dangerous situation.
And I imagine that probably the attacks were made for the same reason that all terrorists attack innocents, and that is to sow terror.
Yes, yes, that could very well be.
So you came back. Tell us what was perhaps the most remarkable experience you had or a thing that you discovered while writing this book, My Brigadista Year.
Well, I was going to go speak at a literacy conference that my friend Emilia Gallego holds every 2 years for Latin America, and she holds it in Cuba. So most of the participants are Cuban, but many of them come from Central and South America and the other islands, Spanish-speaking islands. So before I went, I had learned a lot about the campaign, and I thought, well, I want to include sort of a salute to these teenage literacy workers. When I'm talking to other people who work in literacy around this part of the world, and I sent my speech ahead to be translated, and Isabel Serrano, who's the translator, wrote me back, and she said, you realize that Emilia had been one of the brigadistas, didn't you? And of course, I hadn't known, but once she told me, I thought, ah, oh, that makes perfect sense. This brilliant woman who's a college professor and a writer and who holds this conference and who is very outspoken, it made perfect sense to me that she'd had that life-changing year as a teenager.
Well, that's just beautiful. So let me just ask you then, are you working on any other books at this point?
Well, usually I'm not at this point. I'm usually, because I finish writing a book and I think, well, that was a good career while it lasted, but I'll never write another. And my family used to just roll their eyes. But I really thought, you know, after I finished Day of the Pelican, which was my last novel, that I wouldn't write anymore because I'd had the same editor on all my novels, and she was no longer able to edit because she was older than I was. And my husband, who was always my first editor and chief supporter, along with Virginia Buckley, had died. And I thought, well, you know, it's okay. I'm not one of those down and die if I can't write. I might lie down and die if I couldn't read, but there's nothing stopping me from reading. And I just felt like my brain was in deep freeze. I didn't have any ideas, and I didn't really mind. It wasn't a tragedy to me. And then after I had that trip to Cuba and had learned all about the literacy campaign, I was talking to friends about it, and one of my friends, Lita Schubert, said, well, you should write that story. Mm. And I thought, you know, I wasn't born in Cuba. I was born in China.
Wow.
How could I write that story? And then I thought, well, maybe I could do a nonfiction book about it, because it is an important story. I think we should know this story. And very few people in this country do. And I thought it might be an inspiration for young Americans as well. And so I talked to Karen Lotz, who is a publisher at Candlewick Press, and I've known Karen since she was just barely out of college. And I said, Karen, what would you think if I tried to write this story? I was thinking about, you know, a smallish nonfiction book with lots of pictures, because they have wonderful pictures from the campaign. And she said, well, I can hear the excitement in your voice. I think you should write a novel. And I sat down. I thought, I'm going to write another novel at my advanced age and frozen brain. And then suddenly I could write, and it was just such a joy to write. I just had forgotten how much I loved to write because it, with my husband's illness and death, I really hadn't been able to write anything of any length, and it was just such a joy to suddenly find myself writing again. And so I just have to say it was truly a joy.
And we are so glad you did. It is a lovely novel. It is filled with information that most Americans don't know. And its protagonist is just a wonderful character. Catherine Patterson, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you, Francesca. And best wishes to all those writers out there because, you know, it's not an easy job, but it's a great one if you can get it.
Catherine Patterson. She's the author of more than 30 books, including Bridge to Terabithia and Jacob I Have Loved. My Brigadista Year is out from Candlewick Press. Next up, Jessica Yu's wonderful story of a remarkable woman and the children she saves. It's called Garden of the Lost and Abandoned. But first, let's hear the anthem of the Cuban Literacy Campaign's Conrado Benitez Brigade.
Somos las brigadas Conrado Benítez, somos la vanguardia de la revolución. Con el libro en alto cumplimos una meta, llevar a toda Cuba la alfabetización.
¡Muba! ¡Muba! ¡Estudio para fusil! ¡La pizarrilla mamá, la alfabetizar, alfabetizar! ¡Venceremos! Somos las brigadas, Conrado Benítez. Somos la vanguardia de la revolución. Con el libro en alto cumplimos una meta, llevar a toda Cuba la alfabetización. Guayanos y montañas, el brigadista va cumpliendo con la patria, luchando por la paz. Abajo imperialismo, arriba libertad. Llevamos con las
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The problem, by most lights, is overwhelming. At least 5,000 children live on the streets of Uganda's capital city of Kampala. Some forget the names of their villages. The youngest may not know the names of their parents. But Gladys Kalibala, part journalist, part detective, part Good Samaritan, doesn't hesitate to dive into difficult or even dangerous situations to help a child. Author of a newspaper column called Lost and Abandoned, she's a resource that police and others turn to when they stumble across a stranded kid with a hidden history. Jessica Yu's wonderful and inspiring book about Kalibala and her work is titled Garden of the Lost and Abandoned, the extraordinary story of one ordinary woman and the children she saves. Jessica Yu is an author and filmmaker. Her short, Breathing Lessons, won the Academy Award, and her documentaries center on art, social justice, and the environment. Well, Jessica Yu, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to say this is such a beautifully written and compelling book, Garden of the Lost and Abandoned. I read it from cover to cover, all in one sitting. I spent a whole day doing it, and it was one of the most delicious days I've spent reading in a long time. It's just a wonderful book.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment. I appreciate that.
So this the subtitle says it. It is the extraordinary story of one ordinary woman and the children she saves. First, give us the setting. Tell us where this takes place, and then tell us about Gladys Kalibala. Is that how to pronounce her name?
Kalibala, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes. So Gladys, as the subtitle suggests, is a, quote, ordinary woman. In the stories, you find out that that's a bit of a misnomer, but she is a Ugandan woman who works as a journalist for one of the larger newspapers, and the column is called Lost and Abandoned, and in it she profiles some of the many kids who end up stranded for one reason or another, especially in these urban areas of Uganda, through poverty, misfortune, illness, neglect. There's many reasons. that kids get stranded, and so she does these little profiles to try to reconnect them with their families. That's the simple part of the story. The more complicated part is when she steps far beyond her boundaries as a journalist and becomes involved in trying to trace these kids' stories, find out really what's going on, and to address whatever the most immediate need is. Is it medical care? Is it roof over their heads? Is it food? And of course, trying to find out who knows them and where these kids belong.
Yeah. Now, she has a remarkable backstory herself. I mean, just the way she even became a journalist and how she grew up. So just briefly, give us that story.
Sure. So Gladys was the oldest in a family with 8 kids. Her parents fought a lot. Her father was an alcoholic and not really so present for the family. So for a couple of years, she was sent to live with her grandparents, and that was a very loving home. But then her grandfather passed away. She was left in charge of her siblings because her father abandoned the family and her mother really couldn't cope. So at a young age, I think she was about 17, she had to leave her own schooling and go out and work and start caring for her brothers and sisters. So she ended up coming into journalism later in life when she was in her 40s and starting from there. And I think what she learned from that was that her perspective on life, her life experience, really informed her ability to connect with people out in the world. And from that, she ended up tracing these stories of these children. And she has such also a sense for an ear for where the story a child is telling doesn't hold up, where there might be some possibility. She almost approaches it in a detective-like way at times, and I found it just fascinating that every story ended up having some twist or surprise because she really follows it all the way through.
And then she sometimes has told the stories quite a number of times because the aim is not just to tell the story to the readers, but also to get these children connected back to their families, if that's at all possible.
That's right. I mean, I thought her perspective on this issue is really interesting because she is the liaison between the children, the police and other agencies, their families, the public. I mean, she has a unique position there, and there's no one else who's really doing exactly what she does. I mean, she's not a social worker. She doesn't have an NGO. She doesn't have money. She doesn't have transportation. She's really one woman who's just taken on this mission, and I don't mean that in a religious sense, to do what she can to help the people that she encounters, and something that is very humbling when you get close to it.
She's an amazing human being. Just what was your experience of her as a person as you followed the story for 4 years?
Yes. Well, so I was very drawn to her, not only for the work that she does, but by the fact of her personality, the fact that she's cheerful. I was thinking, how can someone enter such difficult circumstances? I mean, what these kids, a lot of them have been through, it's really hard to hear, you know, kids who are abused or on the streets or dealing with medical conditions. And Gladys, you know, she enters it with this buoyancy that I found so compelling. So that was one thing. The other thing is that she is somebody who is always herself. And I wanted to enter that world of hers, but what I didn't anticipate was how freely she was opening the door for me to see. And I can't tell you what a gift that is. I mean, when you're trying to make a film about somebody or even draw somebody's picture or, you know, tell the stories of what's happening in their life, to have a subject who allows herself to be seen. And I think that that was what kept me going, and it also made it something where my presence was less of a distraction, because everyone sort of ends up getting pulled into Gladys's wake when she shows up at a police station and she wants answers. I mean, everyone just gravitates towards her, and it makes it a lot easier, I think, for me to be the kind of fly on a wall and to be able to focus on really what's happening in the room and not to worry about trying to explain myself.
And we should say that she is a freelance journalist. She gets paid practically nothing. I mean, sometimes she struggles to have enough just to eat. And yet she's giving huge resources, well, whatever she can. They may not be huge by our standards, but certainly by hers, she's giving them away.
Yes. I think that was certainly something that personally drew me to her as well. I mean, I think that, like, especially right now, I mean, there's the in the U.S. and in wealthier countries, you know, we end up talking about compassion fatigue. You know, we get overwhelmed by problems that seem big and constant, complex, and remote. And I think there was something so attractive about the way that Gladys has this kind of optimistic pragmatism. I mean, she enters a situation, she tries to think, okay, well, I can't take care of this big problem yet, but what can I do right now? What, you know, I'll plan for the future, but what does this child need right now? Oh, this child doesn't have shoes. Let's deal with that. And there's something about rediscovering the value in small but persistent actions. And you can see that, especially for some of these kids who have so little, that a small intervention can have such a ripple effect, especially as those actions accumulate over time. So Gladys, what she does, she takes a lot of joy from it. I mean, there's a lot of material in the book that's very bittersweet, but I think overall there's a way that she continues to be able to draw some personal satisfaction at seeing what she's been able to affect and seeing the impact on the kids and their families and communities from just staying in there and meeting people face-to-face.
Uganda seems like an incredibly poor nation. I mean, there are very few resources almost for anyone. I suppose this is partly a result of colonialism and then certainly of the years of chaos, for example, under Idi Amin.
Yes, this is true. And then HIV, there's a lot of disruption that's, you know, happened on various fronts. And then, you know, and the poverty, especially in some of the rural areas, is just intense. I mean, it's a place where in the rural areas, communities are very dependent on agriculture. Women do enormous amount of work just to provide for their families and get through the day. It's a very tough life. So if any bit of that thin fabric that's keeping people afloat gets ripped, it's very, very hard to recover from that. And I think that's where a lot of Gladys's cases come from. You know, something that just tips the balance and then all of a sudden there's a, you know, kid who's stranded from his family.
Yeah. Give us, for example, the example of Douglas. That certainly, I'd say, was something that happened to him. Just, you know, one thing that tipped the balance.
Yes. I love the story of Douglas, and he was one of the children I met who was already sort of under Gladys's care. She has many kids who call her mom. It's very, very interesting. I'll say, oh, another one? You got another son? And Douglas is someone who's very, very smart. He's a very good boy, and it turns out in one of the chapters that he has this shameful secret. And it was something very small. I mean, he had a difficult childhood in that he was abandoned by his parents, but he was under the care of a grand aunt. But he did something, you know, like it's almost like a, not like a childhood prank, but there was something he wanted, and he took money to get it, and it haunted him so badly that he ended up running away from home. And if you run away from home in rural Uganda, you decide to walk to the big city, which he tried to do. You know, he tried to walk. I think it took him a couple of days, and his feet got all swollen, and that's when Gladys met him. If she had not happened to cross paths with him at that time, he could have ended up lost on the streets. And so the tying together of those threads again, I think, is what makes that story so affecting.
And you also talk about the fact that he could have been trafficked as a child. He could have,
yeah.
He could have been kidnapped for his kidneys.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, there are many dangers on the street, and there's the kind of deprivation that is just constant and difficult. And you know, kids just trying to find a place to sleep that's safe, find something to eat. There is a problem of child sacrifice, you know, children being kidnapped there. So there's kind of this, you know, spectrum of dangers out there. And I think that when Gladys gets involved, you know, she's really trying to find a place where, ideally, where kids can be safe, but also where they have a chance of an education and a chance for a little bit of freedom, you know, to be a kid. And that's a tall order. But again, she just kind of chips away at trying to address what needs she can.
And a chance of at an education. There is somebody who, you know, is almost her partner in, not partner in crime, you know, partner in goodness here. Tell us about the school that she ends up being able to send a good number of kids to.
Sure. So it's a school in Entebbe, which is the place where Gladys lives. It's a bit of a commute to Kampala, but it's the early learning school. And it's a school that is supposed to be for tuition-paying students, but Agnes, who runs the school, is kind of, you know, she also has a tender heart and ends up taking in a lot of the kids that Gladys discovers who need an education, need a place to stay. A lot of the schools there are boarding schools, and so it's very interesting how these strong women end up forming these little networks of support. And at a certain point, Agnes has about 10 of quote, Gladys's children. And so it's difficult, though, because Gladys doesn't want to keep burdening her colleague. But sometimes there's no place to take the kids. And that's what leads Gladys to this idea of starting her own project to try to start a little garden or farming project. See if she can raise some money and eventually establish a place to keep kids safely or to support her work out in the field.
Her Perseverance Garden.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the very appropriately named Perseverance Gardens. And this idea of hers was something I didn't know was in the works when I approached her about writing the book, and I did not anticipate that there would be so much drama on that side of things. But it's interesting to me how people who are doing things for others, and empathetic people like Gladys, sometimes find difficulty when they are pursuing something that is as much for themselves as for somebody else. And I feel like that's where it became difficult for Gladys, because she was dealing with you know, adults, and there were some con men and con women and all sorts of disasters and obstacles and difficulties that I think end up really testing her view of her approach to human nature. I don't think she's a naive person, but this idea of trying to not anticipate the worst from somebody off the bat, and then she starts to question whether that is the best tactic. Has she been too trusting? Has she been too open with others?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jessica Yu about her book, Garden of the Lost and Abandoned. It is the extraordinary story of one not-so-ordinary woman, I'd say, and the children she saves. Now, I'd love you to talk about the case of Ezra, you know, from the beginning, but then also tie it in to the garden, because in some ways it is one of the most satisfying parts of the book, I'd say. It's almost as if, I mean, it's like a wonderful fairy story.
It really is. And again, it's so, this is what I loved about having enough time to follow these stories with Gladys, is to see them naturally evolve. And it's almost like seeing some sort of wonderful karmic convergence towards the end. But so to back up, Ezra is one of the kids that Gladys has known for the longest time. Ezra was living in a very poor rural area, and when he was a child, the side of his face started to swell up so that it became difficult for him to speak, even to breathe. He would get terrible headaches. And in his own community, it was difficult because he was ostracized, and he was living with a stepmother who just made him work all the time. And he realized that he needed help for the condition because it kept getting worse. And at 16, he realized, you know, he could die. So he tried to raise money by working in other people's gardens and making bricks and to get money to go to the big city, to go to Kampala, the capital, and to try to find some way to get an operation. And you just think of the gumption of this kid who had to drop out of school, had no money, no family support, and he just decides to take himself to the city. And so when he finally got to the city, having to run the gauntlet of people throwing rocks at him and throwing abuse in his face, he gets there, and then he stops at the offices of where Gladys's newspaper desk is situated at, and they have this chance encounter, and Gladys ends up wanting to help him, and this is turns into like a 5-minute encounter, turns into something that becomes a years-long relationship, and she ends up helping him get this operation. There's a lot of drama in that story and a lot of surprises, and Ezra is just such a lovely young person, and you get to see him sort of grow up. I mean, he's a young man by the time of this book, and so when Gladys gets in all that trouble trying to start this garden project and to try to create something where she doesn't have to keep on depending on the kindness of strangers to help her kids, that it's Ezra who ends up really deciding to step up. I mean, he is the one person, besides some of her official colleagues, who she can really trust. And for Gladys to see this shift in this boy who's always needed her help into somebody who can help her is just a very... it's just so gratifying in a way. And I think also, having observed Gladys, I really feel like I saw her at the end of her rope in terms of this venture. And I think it surprised everyone when Ezra stepped up and said, you know, I can help, I can do this.
It's such a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jessica Yu about her book, Garden of the Lost and Abandoned. It tells the extraordinary story of a Ugandan journalist and the children she saves. And, I mean, in many ways, this is really a study in altruism.
Yeah.
You know, there are many cases of altruistic people. We know about them from the rescuers and the Holocaust. People who derive the greatest satisfaction in their life from helping others. And I just, after all these years of, and then now writing this book, talk about altruism and some of the thoughts that you came to about it.
Oh, it's such a good question, because I do think that that is what drew me to Gladys in the first place. You know, this mystery of character. How was her resilience and empathy forged under the same pressure that crushed so many other people? That was really something that I wanted to get closer to. And I think my answer to what makes Gladys tick is probably a little different from what she would have to say. I don't know that there's one answer, but what I came away feeling is that it's easy to look at her, what she does, and characterize her as some sort of saint, and she hates that. I mean, she's definitely no martyr. I think really what she is a seeker of joy. So there is a way that she is fed by her work, as difficult as it is. And I don't want to minimize the toll it takes on her in every practical way and emotional way. But when, for her, I think the positive, and even if they're small steps, they really outweigh the negative for her. She would probably say that this is just how she was born, that this is just the way you're supposed to act to others. You know, this is what she learned from her kindly grandparents, that it's just common decency. But I think what strikes us so strongly now in this climate where we no longer know what is decent, or we don't have a sense of what is commonly considered decent when we have these arguments in the news and social media and politics over the very definitions of truth and accountability and responsibility, that I think what I was drawn to is the fact that with Gladys, this decency just came back into focus in this really pure way. And it's not always easy for her to act on that impulse. I mean, a lot of times she doesn't have any, she has no resources, she has no money to offer. All she can offer is a bit of face-to-face contact. And that is definitely not nothing, especially in some of these places in Uganda where people have very little, money is so scarce, transportation is extremely difficult. Face-to-face interaction, it's hard to overstate the impact that can have. I've been with Gladys when we had literally driven 6 hours out to the middle of nowhere so she can spend about 6 minutes with some of the kids she has that she hasn't seen for a while, and then we got back in the car and drove 6 hours back. And it sounds bananas, and it kind of was bananas, but I could see in that she wanted to see them. She wanted to lay her eyes on them because that gives her great pleasure to see them, and then she can assess their situation for herself. But also, she wants them to see hers, because just by her very presence standing there in the middle of the bush somewhere, I have no idea where it would be on the map, but they know that she made the effort to come all the way out there and see her, so they can tell that she's involved. So it was those kind of interactions that really stayed with me and just made me think of how it's harder to dismiss what someone else is going through when you're standing in front of them. And it's also, it's clearer that the human exchange of that moment can feed both sides.
And it was super important that she does that also in a particular case where it turned out that a place that she had put some kids was not so savory, was involved in the adoption child trafficking trade. Although in this case, we probably don't want to give too much away, so we won't. I won't go down that road, but yeah. So, yeah, talk about the adoption trade.
Well, this is an interesting subject. I mean, I thought this is an interesting subject for another book. I'm sure there is a book or two out there, but about it. I think what Gladys is interested in when it comes to the welfare of her kids, her first priority is always, can we connect them to a parent, to family, to relatives, to community, to some place where they have an anchor, some place where they belong, even if it's not perfect. And I think that when we think of adoption, especially, let's say, a child being adopted to the U.S. or some wealthier country, we think of that child being, you know, rescued, that this child, oh, you know, they've hit the jackpot. And while it's true that children in adoption, you know, often, usually, I would say, just anecdotally, thrive and get a lot of material advantage, I think Gladys does not want to dismiss not only the idea of cultural heritage, but the child's sense of belonging, of whatever family ties that in some cases, I would say that a child is encouraged maybe not to look back, or it just happens because they're no longer in their home country. But I think Gladys is always trying to retain those ties, retain a sense of that value. So it's a long way of saying that it's a more complicated issue. I think it's more nuanced, and Gladys ultimately wants what's best for the child, but I don't think that she's so easily accepting that, oh, well, the situation always calls for the child to be removed.
And it doesn't necessarily. I mean, as you point out in this book, you know, there are people who are making a whole lot of money off of these kids without really a whole lot of vetting.
Yeah, this is a thing that's difficult about, I think, you know, in Uganda, I mean, I would talk to people about this and see some evidence of this, but there are a lot of, say, children's homes where money is raised for children, and these places are corrupt. They're not reliable. We don't know where the money is going, or we do know that the money is not going to kids, or where kids are put up for adoption, and we don't know that the proper vetting has happened to make sure that the children do not still have family. Actually, there were several cases, many cases that didn't end up in the book for one reason or another. A lot of times it would be that I just didn't have the closure in the story. But I did go with Gladys once where we went to visit a young boy who had been reunited with his father. And the father had placed his children in what he thought was a school. And it was a front for then the school, this so-called school would turn around and put kids up for adoption. So this kid was, and he was taken with a bunch of other kids, and they were being trafficked. And so through Gladys's intervention and following the story, the kids ended up being reunited with their father. And some of the other kids, I guess, were returned as well. Again, this was a story that happened in the past, so that was also why I didn't end up putting it in into the book. But that is a clear case of family ties being disregarded by disreputable forces, and the kids really being caught in the middle.
Well, it is just a terrific book. And I also want to really compliment you on the beauty of the writing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was, I have to say, because I'm normally a filmmaker, I really appreciated the fact that I didn't have to travel with a crew and with equipment meant that I could just sit and focus and really be in the moment. And so I think that helped, I think, maybe in just thinking visually, and but thank you.
Yeah, and are you making a film of this book?
No, you know, I actually met Gladys when I was researching a documentary on population issues, so she ended up being one of several stories in that production, but for that I was only able to film with her for a few days, so it was out of that research and filming with her that I decided that I couldn't just move on, that there was so much more that I wanted to know, and so that's what led to the idea of making a book about her.
Well, I see a Hollywood movie in this book.
Right. Well, any chance to spend more time in Gladys's world, I would jump at.
That's great. Well, Jessica Yu, thank you so much for talking with us here. The book is Garden of the Lost and Abandoned. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Yu, in addition to being an author, she is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker. To read an excerpt from Garden of the Lost and Abandoned, go to writersvoice.net. And finally, we mourn the passing of one of America's greatest mystery writers. Sue Grafton died on December 28th at the age of 77. She was the best-selling author of the alphabetically titled Kinsey Millhone series. We spoke with her in 2016 about her book, X. Go to writersvoice.net to hear that interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.